Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Vivek Show, which is probably one of several that we're going to be doing that I like to call the series Mike Hates Horror. Joining us on episode one of Mike Hates Horror, we're going to be discussing the film Backrooms with two people that probably aren't going to have the same opinion of me, though I don't want to speculate, but I'm joined happily by Jason Diamond. How are you, Jason?
Great. Happy to be on the inaugural episode of what I will call MH squared.
Okay. Matt Wallen, how are you, Matt?
I'm good. Yeah.
So it's become apparent over the years of doing the VFX show, and Lord only knows we've done a few episodes, that we don't review a lot of horror films. And the reason for this is quite simply that I'm a big scaredy cat and I don't like horror. And so the guys were pleading with me saying, you know, get over yourself, Seymour. We should do Backrooms because it's awesome. It's, you know, really, you should see it. It's a terribly important film. And of course, one of the youngest directors ever in the US, if not the youngest director ever, to get a number one film at the US box office. A24 is like, you know, I think it's the third highest grossing horror film ever now already. And it's received all sorts of attention. Because it's, you know, low budget, not unknown actors, but certainly not, you know, some sort of big marquee.
Unknown actors. They have two Oscar nominees, bro.
Okay. But I mean, it's not like it's a film where you're going for the actors. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't realize they were Oscar nominated and I apologize. But it's not like like a De Niro film or something where you go.
No, yes. Agreed.
You with me?
Yes.
I don't think people are going to the film primarily because of the names of the actors or the name of the director. They're going because of word of mouth on the film, I presume. But I don't know.
I would argue that there is definitely a subset, which would include my son and all of his friends, that went specifically because of Cain Parsons and the fact that he is the number one creator of the most watched version of his version of Backrooms lore on YouTube.
Cain Pixels is his moniker. Yeah.
But that is not the entire audience that's going is not that. But there is definitely a solid base that sort of probably drove opening weekend.
So because I reluctantly researched this, I know that it did in fact come from an actual department store and it ended up with a still image that ended up with a YouTube thing. But give us the backstory for those that haven't been forced to do research like I have.
So the basic, I think it's 2022 is the first image. I could be wrong and we'll put it in the show notes. I'll send it to you, Mike. It was a photo that I think was eventually traced to the Midwest somewhere, Nebraska maybe. And or Toledo or someplace like that, is a photo that someone took in the back of a furniture store that was being renovated or whatever. And they took a picture and they wrote like a cryptic paragraph, short paragraph about if you get caught in the back rooms, you know, X, Y, and Z will happen. And it was just this one image. And as happens on the internet, people found it on, I think, 4chan and Reddit and other places, and ran with it and saw, what is this? You know, it became what's on the internet the kids call creepy pasta, which is like creepy
what
stories,
creepy pasta.
Yeah.
Okay. God, it's you like are so these, down with the young people. Go on.
It's these, well, I have a 19-year-old who was younger when this came out and he was following all of it. And he would play in the car, you know, it's like these stories that people write about creepy things are all made up, and it's, you know, not unlike all the UFO message boards of people making up all their stories. Not that some of them may not be true or may be true, but you know, there's obviously a lot of alliteration and other things going on. And so that grew and grew and grew. And because no one actually owns this IP and it comes from just a random post, you start getting these branches of content that people are making that they're inspired by that image and the lore to create their content. Cain Parsons being one of them, who started making these quote found footage stories, videos that he had done primarily in Blender with some filmed stuff, I think initially, but you know, really just built up this framework in this story of, I think it's a total of like 3 hours of material or something, maybe a little more. And it just that he just whatever he was doing, just everybody who was into the backroom stuff latched onto his vibes.
I think another thing too that I found really interesting and that I feel like is relatable, you know, maybe for your son Lucas and for my son too, like, you know, some of these younger filmmakers like Kane Parsons and some of these other characters that maybe we'll get into talking about a little bit later, but they were all in high school or middle school during the pandemic. And so they've grown up, you know, with digital technology. They spent a lot of time isolated and alone in pivotal years. You know, they've been living through, as we all have, but they've sort of grown up with this corporate consolidation of so much media. And I think there's, for a lot of them, you know, they're being, I know Kane Parsons talks about spending a bunch of time during the pandemic at home on his laptop, watching tutorials, learning Blender, like really getting into this very, when you hear him speak, I mean, he's highly intelligent and very incredibly well-spoken. I mean, he's a really smart kid or young man. And his approach to, you know, really systemically and analytically breaking down how to work as a visual effects artist, primarily really doing a lot of this stuff totally digitally, is super exciting. And I think a lot of these kids that grew up in that era, like you just look at, you know, so many 20 somethings right now, and, you know, they have a real thirst for things that are authentic, and like they're going back and listening to and buying like CDs and vinyl and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think that there's the hunger for things that look real or feel like they can have some genuine ownership over. And I think, you know, a set of young filmmakers, Kane Parsons being one, come along and they make these videos on YouTube, and they become incredibly popular and have so many followers, and there's all this lore surrounding it. And then the opportunity comes up to make a feature film. There's already a built-in audience for some of this stuff. And it's not a, I would argue, I mean, I think it's not a dumb movie. Like, it's a compelling structure. It has very some Jungian kind of, you know, archetypal stuff in it, some psychological horror, the idea of, you know, the things that are frightening are these liminal spaces, and the idea of kind of being lost in a world where you know, like, walls don't make sense, you know, the whole thing of like you know, rules that don't apply in the normal way. And it's kind of the way a lot of these young people grew up too. So some of the story content, I think, really imbues the way in which I think a lot of them experience the world very different, maybe from the way we did growing up, with where things seemed a little bit more, slightly more predictable, slightly more stable, certainly in Western societies and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, what I will add one quick small thing that to that liminal sort of horror is that in the lore, you no clip, meaning you like declip through things, and walking through a wall intentionally is a plot point of the movie. In the videos and the lore pre this movie, you fall into these things unknowingly. You take a step backwards and you're stuck in the back rooms and can't get out, which is a more existential dread kind of.
Well, and just real quick, I know, Mike, you were going to say something, but real quick, I think it also connects to, you know, video game culture too. Like in the way that, you know, you look at, I mean, if you've ever been playing any kind of a first person or third person game and your character dies and falls through the ground plane, you're looking at, you know, the reverse normal, right? So every half of the things, you're falling through nothing into a liminal space within a game universe where you're only seeing the normals that are still facing, you know, your camera controller of your player character, and everything else is sort of half invisible. And I think there's also a strange connection to sort of the experiential nature of virtual worlds and like technical glitches that can occur in that too, that become a part of the way young people, I mean, really I mean, anybody really playing games can experience those worlds too. So,
Mike.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here, right? So I get the Wolfenstein 3D kind of wall thing, right? Like you're just going through as a first-person shooter culturally. And there are all these kind of normally 90-degree angled walls, and you can't kind of tell where you are, and it's a bit of a maze and you're trying to map it out. And I get that it's resonated with audiences. I acknowledge that for many people it's a really good film. That it's not dumb is something that I'll be unpacking in a second, in the sense that it's formulaic, as is nearly all horror, as is like Why I Don't Like It. And also it's like getting cheap laughs. You get cheap jump scares. In fact, the opening audio gave me a jump scare when the title for, I think, A24 just suddenly changed to the first image of the movie, right? But it was an audio jump scare as much as anything. Okay, but all of that. But I want to unpack something that Matt said, which is that it's sort of like a unique thing to this generation, different to what we had. Tell me, Matt, how this isn't the Blair Witch Project of this generation.
I mean, I guess you could draw that analogy. I sort of feel like there's a deeper psychological component, at least in the way I experienced this movie. I feel like there's a deeper psychological aspect to it that gets more into, I don't know, I don't know quite how to describe it, maybe a way in which so much of who you are and whatever your psychological issues may be, those things manifest in this space in a different way. Whereas I think the Blair Witch Project, well, I mean, I actually think that was a really innovative, film for its time, for sure. The found footage concept, right? I mean, it was a huge movie. But I think there's something about that that's more like a kind of, it's a supernatural story. And I think that this is more, it's kind of more science fiction in a way, but it also feels like it's more like a sort of a psychological movie. I don't know if I would call it horror in a way.
Well, it's existential dread. It's like True Detective kind of, what have you. But not True Detective directly, but the sort of the Lovecraftian kind of dread of, existential dread thing. But I understand what you're saying 100%, Mike. And I would say actually I'm in between the two of you, because I do agree that if you actually look at the lore of Backrooms, it does come from a quote found footage scenario, right, which is directly the Blair Witch and that kind of world. And yes, it is, for all intents and purposes, it is just a psychological horror film that happens to be in a more modern framework. And I would say the thing I think that differentiates it is that for films, certainly of someone of his age, Kane Parsons' age, but also in the way that, since I do watch horror and I do see the trends of all the things that are getting made, this is the least in-your-face horror film that has been out in a very long time. And I found it to be quite fascinating because it's very ambient in a lot of ways.
So, yeah.
And that is not typical of the genre currently.
So let's also agree that there are many, like horror has so many subgenres, right?
Yes.
Like there's an Australian percent. Film coming out in a couple of weeks, which I think is queer gay horror, right? And that queer horror is like a subgenre that, I'm sure we'll find an audience. And there is like sort of very gratuitously violent things. And there are ones that are much more kind of, you'd almost say sexist and sort of a male gaze kind of thing that ends up with women in their underwear. But leaving that aside for a second, I mean, I agree that you can't just say, to say it's just horror is to sort of imply that all horror films are the same and they're not. But it does share many tropes that are it seems to me, like, I don't think it's bad filmmaking. Like, I don't think that this guy that's made it is a bad director or that it's not worthy of a whole bunch of people seeing it. But I went and saw it, and I was the oldest guy there by, like, many dimensions. I mean, there was basically a whole bunch of, like, I'm going to say 15 to 17 or 18-year-old mm-hmm. boys and girls who were goofing off most of the way through the whole film. Like, if I'd been, like, that kind of guy, I'd have turned around and told to shut up. And they were, like, running out to getting popcorn and running back in and, like, mm-hmm. tripping over each other. And literally one of them, like, fell over the seats in front of them into the seats in front of them and kind of went under the seat because somebody had dropped their, you know, chocolate bar or something. It was just – and every time something gross happened, they laughed, yeah? So
yeah.
So let me just start by saying this genre was not designed for me. Right?
Yeah.
I'm sure that they thought I was some kind of pervy old guy that, you know, was, like, turning up just to where the young kids were, which is, you know, quite a concerning way to be sort of viewed. But I was there for one reason and one reason only, to be able to do this show. I didn't go with anyone because I didn't know anyone that wanted to go with me that would go and want to see this film. Okay, so don't you feel like, if I could just characterize a few things, like, firstly, the found footage stuff, like, it's very easy to make things seem scary when you can't see and yeah. you've got a sense that there's something behind you. And so when you've got that handy cam view, there's always a sense that they're looking one way, but something's going to be happening behind them. And mm-hmm. you can't quite see what's going on. And the music is, like, building. And it's not like we haven't seen that before. It's also not like we haven't seen a woman attacked, then held hostage, then manages to break free, then chased by an evil but slower sort of, you know, kind of lumbering thing that, even though it's huge and lumbering, seems to always manage to catch up with her, and that she isn't, like, you know, in kind of ripped clothes and just manages to get through and is rescued at the last minute. But wait, there's a twist at the end, and the twist at the end is the thing that you thought was dead isn't really dead, and there's going to be a sequel. And it's like, you know, and there's always a nod and a wink to the audience. And if it isn't, like, that creature peering around the corner from the back or moving when you thought it was dead, it's, in this case, a shot of her in this poorly remembered alternative reality of sci-fi horror where things are poorly constructed. And then there are some obvious gross-out moments, like ripping the guy's stomach out to eat it is just purely there to gross you out. It would have been only grosser if it had been bleeding when he pulled bits of the guy's stomach apart. But, like, there's no point. I mean, that was just, you know, like, just, we need a bit where it's just really gross out. And, of course, all the 15-year-olds behind me were like, you know, like this, and all their girlfriends were, like, looking away in horror. But it was just like, yeah, you know, obviously. And then putting the I'm going to call it woman's scalp over our lead heroine's head is, again, just like a gross out moment that makes you feel bad, but not so gross that, you know, you still wouldn't want to, like, date her if you were single. Like, that kind of, like, weird kind of thing. And she's always really attractive, and she's always, like, intelligent, and she's always, oh my God, it's in the house, get out kind of thing, right? She's not stupid. She's not a bimbo, but she's also doing really friggin' stupid things. It's like the number of times you want to yell at the screen and go, no, you moron, walk out, or go the other way.
You are literally describing the pleasure of horror movies right now.
But that's my
point.
Although
I do want to say that, Matt, how does it feel to not be the grumpy one on the call? That's all I want to say.
It's weird.
But I don't disagree with you, Mike. I believe that, yes, it is, no one, I don't think I or Matt or anyone who's seen this film has lauded it as a transcendental shift in the nature of horror. I think it's seen very often franchises that or IP that makes its way out of the trenches that people feel real ownership of, that gets onto the big screen, gets fucked in every way possible. Because the studio's trying to wring every weird thing out of it.
So I totally applaud. I totally applaud that this wasn't a franchise. I totally applaud
what people are responding to.
Yep. I mean, I have a friend who, I won't name the film, but he did a short film and a studio bought it, and they ended up with another director making it, and they just turned it into kind of a schlocky kind of very obvious thing. And he was like, you know what? They paid me for it. I had to walk away because it wasn't my vision. And I feel really bad for him. And his short was magnificent. And the feature was something I didn't want to see.
Yeah.
So I applaud all of that, right? And I even applaud that there are whole genres that I just don't want to see. So like, why should I be grumpy guy? I'm not. Like, I'm okay.
No, I get films. It. We're forcing you into it. It's okay.
No. But I'm saying, like, it's okay that there are films out there that I don't want to see. I mean, I'm sure that there are. I don't want to go and see. I have technical reasons for wanting to see, but I don't actually want to see the Michael Jackson film because I'm really not comfortable with, like, you know, things outside the film over that. And there are other films I just don't want to see that genre. Because,
I mean, I had to watch Interstellar and I had to watch Dunkirk.
It wasn't like we made you watch Cats.
Yeah.
We all have our cats, Mike.
But the other thing is, like, don't you find, okay, for me, one of the reasons I don't like horror is I'm just sitting there going, you are manipulating me. You are goddamn manipulating me. I am sitting here. You are manipulating me. I don't like being manipulated, you bastard. Like, I really push back.
But you don't think James Cameron's manipulating you in Avatar? I mean, all films are manipulation by the director.
With a warm cinematic hug. I can be
that's the type of, so you just care about the type of manipulation.
I don't like being,
you don't care about being manipulated.
No, I just want to be guided by a friend, and warmly embraced.
Good horror movies, to me, you feel the pressure and the manipulation of where they're pushing you, but it's done with confidence and vision. Shitty horror is when you see everything coming and it's still not good, because everyone knows when a jump scare is coming, and good horror makes that not matter, right? Story can be like Longlegs. Longlegs, I thought, was a great horror film because it had all these things. And yeah, you could guess a bunch of stuff and it's fine. But they also like buried these visuals in there of like the real like Baphomet devil in the shadows and stuff. And they start giving you these things to start looking at and figuring out while stuff is happening. Even I think we talked briefly about Undertone. It's super independent horror that they decided their gag was going to be based around audio. And they used the trope of someone recording a true crime podcast and how that figured into everything. And so you have audio as the jump scare trope. And of course, there's visual jump scares or whatever, but they all kind of pick their gag. And then they just, if they do it right, they just nail it.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but let's agree that when a trope isn't done well, it's just a cliche.
100%.
And the cliches are, let's have our monster with extra eyes. There's a movie coming out called Minions with Monsters, and because it's a kid's funny film, the monster is basically a blob with just lots of eyeballs. And in this, guess what? Our grotesque, hideous, like, reimaginings or rememberings of echoes of people since whatever have multiple eyeballs. Like, it's just like, stick an eyeball. Pan's Labyrinth, stick an eyeball in his hand. Like, it's just, stick an eyeball anywhere, and that's how you're going to make it like kind of weird and freaky. Like, stick an eyeball in the middle of someone's forehead. It's an easy.
I would make the same argument about the design of sci-fi monsters over the last 15, 20 years that all look the same. It looks like, you know, whatever visual effects house was like, you know, monster kit 101, pick from this monster and this arms, this face, this thing. I mean,
or the cliche that I've heard so many times from so many concept people is they'll say like, yeah, they came to me and they said like, well, we want it to be like Giger's Alien, but we don't want it to look like the Alien.
Yeah.
And then inevitably, like, it always kind of winds up looking a little bit like the Alien, you know, like, I mean, there are places in which people get trapped. I mean, one thing I was just going to say, and I think you alluded to it, Mike, in a way, like, you know, your maybe not so pleasant theatrical experience with this movie. I do think it reminded me of like when I was probably a teenager in high school and going to see Children of the Corn.
Yeah.
The original Children of the Corn movie and like sitting with some friends from I guess probably from high school. and sitting in like just they were making they, everybody's cracking jokes and just laughing so hard. And it's like we just sat there and like goofed on the movie the whole time, and it was so fun. And the theater was packed, you know, and it did good business. You know, it was at the time when movies were such a much bigger deal in a way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the experience you had with all the annoying young people like making a ruckus and, you know, whatever else, it's kind of cool in a way because, you know, I mentioned this last show, like there's been so much discussion about like the death of cinema, the end mm-hmm. of movies and like the death of the multiplex. And to have a whole bunch of young filmmakers who are coming out and they're making movies that speak directly to their generation, directly to their audience.
I applaud that. It's and look, so I didn't exciting. Turn around and tell them to shut up because
I know.
I remember
I know,
being I just, young. I, just mean I remember actually like, having a sense of humor. Like, no,
I
honestly.
I just think it's great that it's a force that's bringing audiences, young audiences to movies. It made me think of, you know, in the 60s, right? I think it was in the late 60s or early 70s, Dennis Hopper made Easy Rider. Right? Mm-hmm. And at the time when that movie came out, it was a very low budget independent movie. And it made bank at the movies because, I mean, it was kind of at the peak of the, you know, kind of post-60s drug culture and stuff. And it kind of spoke to that sense of that lost generation of people who are sort of, you know, being sent off to
I mean, even
Vietnam
Albert Brooks, uses Easy Rider as a plot point in Lost in America.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, I think it speaks to that thing where there's like there was the classic old Hollywood studio system, and then there's this generational shift where there's a new kind of cinema, a new I mean, it's not an Easy Rider is just one example. I mean, there's so many other movies that come to the fore, including like the Spielberg and Lucas kind of movies, you know, the big blockbuster, you know, Jaws and Close Encounters and Star Wars and things like that. But I think it's exciting to see young filmmakers, the obsession director, the guy who made Iron Lung,
Markiplier,
and
Curry Barker,
Curry Barker, my son says I gotta go see Obsession, I haven't seen that one yet, but it's exciting to see a new generation of filmmakers coming to the fore and making movies that speak directly to their generation. And I'm cool with if I kind of am there. I want to be there for it. I'm kind of into it, maybe because I have a kid that age or something. But I'm also cool if I don't get it. And I kind of think that it's exciting. It's really cool to see
I'm okay with
box office
it.
Numbers.
Like but I will,
a million-dollar movie, the Obsession movie, making like it's made over like $250 million.
It was $750 and it'll cross $300.
I mean, it's crazy.
This was a $10 million movie and it's going to cross $330, I think.
Yeah, but it's incredible.
But Mike, remember, the three of us are talking as, even though you don't like horror, you completely understand the structure and the idea of it, clearly, by your griping. But remember that the 15 to 20 year old kids have not been, you know, they are not saturated and inundated and over the trope. They are still there and ready for it. And so there is this like tiered, you know, focus group of people
I am worried that, you know, the next wave, which was on the last wave, Marvel superhero films, will all be just horror films, right? And I won't be able to go and see anything
at the cinema
because it'll all be just back-to-back horror. And
we're definitely in it now. I mean, it's climbing for sure, but there is some, like, I would say, we didn't do a show on it, but there's a movie called Don't Speak, I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
The Swedish one, Swedish-Danish one that is, I mean, it's more of a thriller than a horror, although it kind of ends in a horror. That movie is phenomenal. The American remake is trash.
Yeah.
Because they Americanized it and added the things that you could completely arguing about, Mike. And I agree with you 100%. In the American one, you're like, why do I need this?
So I will say there are a couple of films that you might classify as, you know, alt horror or like, you know, like adjacent horror, like Aliens or Alien. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a horror film, but it certainly like scared the shit out of me at times because it was like,
it's noir. Well done. It's noir horror, basically.
But okay. But like, notwithstanding that, like at some point we're going to talk about the visual effects of the film.
Yeah.
But again, you know, like I'm okay with people making things that I don't like, and I'm okay with people making films that, you know, also I'm really happy for them to make an original film. Like anyone that makes an original film that finds an audience is great. And I agree with you, especially post-COVID. I think the COVID generation that sort of got shuttered in and now, and especially with sort of pressures of how expensive it is to go out to restaurants or how expensive it is to do other things, and going to cinemas. But boy, it's not, I'm not looking down the list of upcoming films going, oh, I can't wait for that. And also, by the way, once a film like this gets successful, and I'm not saying it'll happen with Backrooms, but remember Saw, which was at its time
know,
meant to be like incredibly pivotal.
Like eight of them.
And then it was like, yeah, exactly. And then I've read, I don't know if it's, I think it's true, that the directors are like, you know, anything, based on makers make another Saw kind of thing. And they're like, well, but, you know, we'll make another Saw. We don't want to do anything.
James Wan, who was the director of Saw 1, was him and Jason Blum, you know, from Blumhouse, were, I think, early champions of Cain Parsons. And I read a thing from James Wan that said when he had his first phone call with Cain Parsons about the film, he didn't know he was 16.
Yeah.
Talked to him 3 years ago. And he's like, the way, to your point, Matt, the way he spoke about his ideas and spoke, and he's very well spoken, it's like that scene in Almost Famous when they find out he's 19 or whatever.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's on the phone, so like, to the Rolling Stone. Exactly.
It's like
I
crazy,
thought,
you know.
Super bright, super bright young man. Yeah.
Which what also reminds me of the same thing that happened to the singer, Lorde. The record label found her when she was 16. And they incubated her and worked with her until she was about 19 to put out that first record. But they saw the talent and they nurtured it for, you know, behind the scenes until they could really. So they did this, you know, the same thing happened with Cain Parsons, is they're nurturing along the way.
What I thought was going to happen, by the way, at the end of this film is I thought they were going to do a Terry Gilliam ending, which is that she'd be out, she'd be safe, she'd be talking to them. And then it would cut to her lying on a thing somewhere
in this
psychosis kind of state, and them going, "I think she's gone. Yeah, I think she's really gone this time. She's coming back from this." And it was all like the last part of the film of her be surviving was all like an illusion. The Dallas, I just woke up, and everything we've seen in the previous is a dream. Bad dream is a horrendous.
Staying
track.
Elsewhere,
or Newhart, I think did it first, right?
But anyway, okay, so visual effects wise, this film was interesting because they did use visual effects, even though it looked like they didn't at times. And the times I'm referring to is all of that found footage. That found footage, as I'm sure you guys know, was actually shot high res, high quality, and then degraded in post, which I found fascinating. Would you, if you were the supervisors that were hired for that, would you have gone down that route?
100%. I mean, I saw a thing with Jeremy Cox, the DP, and he's like, we tried shooting it on VHS, like natively, and we just realized we were just boning ourselves with color and all the other things that we want to do to be able to control what's happening in post. So they shot on a Komodo in Super 16 mode.
Yeah.
So that they could, you know, and it's a small camera, so you get that same nodal vibe of a small camera, and shot what they had to shoot, you know, dealt with an actual R3D real file, did what they had to do, and then printed it to VHS and brought it back, which is reminiscent of like what Frasier did on Batman, where he shoots digitally, prints out to film scans back in, and then, you know, does touch-ups and things there where they're mixing and matching, you know, different shots that are, you know, digital or film to make everything match. Like it's the same functionality, and you just need the control to get to the end result.
The same interview, I think, is one that I shared with you guys in our initial chat about this, was the DP, and he was talking about too how they did a lot of like that. The director, Cain Parsons, had built out exact replicas mm-hmm. of all of the sets and all of yep. the environments and mapped out everything and had done so much prep. And he built all the stuff in Blender. And yep. so he had it set up so that they could go, and he was teaching the DP how to do stuff in Blender, and the DP pays him a really nice compliment. He says, like, and I sat down and it was like watching this wizard at work, you know, the speed with which he could do stuff. Like when yeah. you sit down and watch somebody who's a master of any 3D yeah. software, you're just sort of like, damn. But then that he was showing the DP how to do some of that kind of similar stuff. And then they wound up doing, which makes perfect sense, like scouting locations,
yeah,
coming up with different setups yeah. and really thinking about how are we going to shoot this particular sequence? Where do we want to put the camera for, you know, this shot, and how do we want to move the camera through the scene? And yeah. I think that's also like really, really exciting that the director and the DP are engaging here with an open source 3D yeah. tool set and really putting it through its paces in a, you know, very traditional kind of visual effects mindset, very reminiscent of the kind of things that Magnopus was doing with, what was it, the
Lion King
and stuff like that, where they're scouting locations
yeah.
in VR. But here they're just kind of doing it on a screen in Blender and sharing setups.
Well, and also to that point, they sort of did what they did on Birdman, which was tape out sections on the stage floor to understand the relationship between how long a hallway is and how it's going to feel when the camera sees it, and what they can build in Blender. And they have a hallway that's 20 feet long, but they can't, even though they built 36,000 square feet of hallways and rooms and things on a big giant soundstage in, I think, Vancouver, you know, you're still limited by space. And just like in Birdman, in the sets they built to replicate the back of the theater, back of house, where they could go through stairs, they changed the length of the hallway to in Birdman so that they could have the right timing to get from point A to point B, or narrow it to make it feel this, you know, this or that. And they did the same thing here. So they pre-vised it, and then they taped stuff out on the floor, and we're like, oh, okay, we need to make it narrower if we can't make it longer, and all the sort of geometric stuff. So I find that stuff fascinating, because, you know, typically a $10 million movie wouldn't have that amount of resource.
Yeah.
What did you think of Captain Clark, the somewhat pirate, somewhat Jamaican monster?
That was the same actor that was the alien in, what was
Romulus?
Romulus, the really tall guy who played the
man baby thing,
man human creature. It's the same actor. They because he's so exceptionally tall, they cast him in that role, and, you know, augmented, I think, some of the face and stuff with some digital movement and whatnot. But I thought it was kind of interesting. It's a, you know, it's a version of Clark, right? Like the sort of angry mm-hmm. Clark character that we see at the beginning of the film, where he's making the commercial for his furniture store that never has a single customer, mm-hmm. it seems, where he actually also lives, which is sort of sad. But it's kind of the back rooms sort of misremembering and experiencing that character in this particular way. And
can I just
it's
make
a manifestation
one point about,
of that. It's pretty compelling. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Ever since Fargo, a very large car park that's virtually empty mm-hmm. with space for cars to come, but only a couple are there, has a hauntingly stronger than, like, it's batting above its weight in terms of cinematic presence. Like, when you see that car park outside the thing, and there's just like the car pulls up in a seemingly random spot, given that there are just so many spots that are empty. I don't know. There's something about that that is just deeply worrying.
I think it speaks to that kind of
it's a liminal space of its own.
Yeah, it's the economic sort of, you know, I would argue it's sort of the, you know, the extreme example of like the broad failures of a just unregulated capitalist society, where all of these strip malls have been built all across, at least certainly all across the United States. I mean, I don't know if you have that in Australia, Mike, but it, like, there's so many strip malls like that where for years, that was, you know, certainly in Southern California, you know, mm-hmm. you see that all over the place. And that was where the supermarket was and the discount furniture yeah. store, the mattress store, all of these things. And they're just built really cheaply just mm-hmm. to serve this very specific purpose that is about selling goods. And then over time, you know, when a recession hits or when people move to a different neighborhood or there's some other kind of economic downturn, you wind up with these huge structures and storefronts that are just closed and there's nothing in there. You know, it's where they put all this, you know, the joke is like Spirit Halloween. You
yeah.
know? It's where all the Halloween costume stores go up every year.
Yeah.
Can By I? Way, I oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, when my rant earlier, I also found it just enormously unsatisfying when the, is it Async? Anyway, the Async guy at the end says, well, we used to make MRI machines and then we found an alternate mm-hmm. universe. And I'm like, I'm sorry, how did an MRI machine? I mean, that's basically instead of saying, there's a bit of tech over here that most of you don't understand. So we'll just make an allusion to that. And then because you don't understand it, it's probably a small leap that you imagine that it somehow unlocked a multidimensional space with horror sort of in.
I mean, that is the lore is that Async has basically figured out how to use MRI type technology on a larger scale. And that's what's allowing them to, that Async themselves are actually the ones creating this.
No, also, I realize that, but yeah, yeah. it's like saying, hey, we had a hamburger thing here. We automatically made hamburgers that squirted yeah. automatic amounts of tomato sauce. And then we discovered an alternate space because of it.
Yeah.
But everyone understands how a grill works. So nobody goes, oh, plausible. But they yeah. go, MRI machine. I don't even know what MRI stands for. So it must be tech and it must be evil, or at least it could be evil.
Again, to be fair, that's all part of the stuff that Kane Parsons came up with before the film. So it's not specifically for
But
I guess I would say I totally agree with you. Like that specific instance of the idea of MRI, like a magnetic resonance imaging machine, would have some ability to create mystical all these liminal spaces or whatever.
But it has magnets and electricity.
But I would argue one of the things about it that's kind of interesting, I think, is that, you know, if you get an MRI of your head, right? Mm-hmm. Or a CT scan of your head, but probably is more compelling. But, you know, the ability to see the structures of one's brain and all the different sort of, in I've a CT that, scan, all the different layers. Yes, so have I. And, you know, it's pretty fascinating. And I think for a sort of science fiction-y movie that doesn't necessarily have to adhere to the nature of reality in the way that a movie like Altered States is totally ridiculous in that regard. It's kind of cool to think that part of what's happening in the story is that the scans of all these people's brains is pulling out more like some other kind of information that isn't also, just the imaging data. And that's what's manifesting in these kind of weird replicated spaces.
They must have edited that piece of exposition out of the movie.
And also remember, if you move during a MRI or a CAT scan, you get the repeated scan,
no, that's true.
Which is why the faces look like that. So, I mean, it's all sort of baked in there.
Are you just post-rationalizing that?
No. I'm not saying that's why they did. I'm just saying that is an actual function of that.
Okay.
If
you guys had attended like a workshop to solve the ending and come up with intelligent things like that, that would have been very satisfying.
But it's as much of a kind of absurd leap as
Christopher Nolan had made this film, they'd be explaining it much better.
Like Ex Machina kind of, Devs, you know, the movie, the series Devs kind of delves into like certain things that are so ridiculous that you could, you know, retrace the position of electrons and molecules all the way back through time to see like the crucifixion of Christ or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think,
that was a bit of a stretch.
But I think you go to a science fiction movie or a film like this that's really, you know, it's like you could say it's kind of a stoner kind of idea too, in a way. But you go to movies like this, I think, in a way, because you are interested in that kind of, you know,
albeit
somewhat pseudo intellectual pursuit. Okay. Like, you know, the whole story of the therapist and her relationship with her mother, and like this mm-hmm. kind of that her mother, you know, seems to have some kind of psychological deep psychological issues, and that, you know, she won't let her daughter go outside because she's afraid. She's like a, what do you call it?
Agoraphobic.
Yeah. And like won't go outside and is sort of a hoarder. And, you know, I think those things tying like the childhood of the character to then the experience of, you know, becoming a therapist, but then also like the manifestation of things in the background. It's interesting. I mean,
that was just a ridiculous side plot.
I have a visual thing that I want to bring up that I think that I found fascinating. And what I found fascinating, because I dabble in Blender, but I've watched a million tutorials about people doing cool stuff. And I will say, because it deserves a shout out, Kane Parsons very specifically shouted out Ian Hubert as like the OG Blender everything guy, because he is. The guy's a genius, and all of his... If you have not seen any Ian Hubert videos, watch all of them, because he gave like a talk that I found fascinating about at some conference that he gave about how he thinks about all this stuff in world building in relation to how he uses Blender and whatever. He's a super smart guy, and he does amazing things in his garage with green screen and Blender and compositing and CG. But what I found fascinating visually is that the back rooms looks like somebody learning Blender.
Yeah.
And I don't say that negatively.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of primitives. There are lots of things that are tiled and repeated. There's textures that are sort of the same, you know, wallpaper pattern tiled. More importantly is the way things are piled up. Like, I look at the thing and there's like the room full of couches, and I'm like, okay, that I literally in the theater, I was like using this like Blender tutorial mentality that I was like, this is what it reminds me of. Like, you went to Turbo Squid and bought a couch and just piled up repetiled or however you wanted to do it. You threw 10 couches in there and they clip each other out and they sort of half merge and one's in the ceiling and whatever. And like, you're like, oh, that looks cool. Again, I'm not diminishing Kane Parsons' work, but to me, it was a very unique look to me, because it felt like you were looking at someone learning something, how to do something, at the same time they actually made it functional and work.
Well, so that's such a cool connecting the design language, the visual effects, to the very nature in which the filmmaker himself learned the tricks of the trade that led him to build the narrative structures and environments. Like you think FX PhD, you know, or whatever the online system is that somebody's engaging in, like there is a meta kind of experience that one has in engaging really deeply with something like that with a machine and building these virtual environments. That's cool.
So let's assume for a second that we're not judging this as a student film or as a product of somebody that's got a special get out of jail free card because they're early in their career. Just judging it from a visual effects point of view, were there any shots that you thought were really good and any shots that you thought, you know, you saw issue with? Again, I understand that I should be saying insanely great given the budget or insanely great given the...
No, I mean, because he had visual effects artists and other people working on it, but I don't know if we need to use budget for anything specifically.
Okay.
I thought it all looked really good. I didn't have nothing jumped out at me in a negative way.
Yeah. I thought, like, you know, in terms of visual effects, design, structure and execution, I mean, I think there's that one sequence, I think it's after Clark sort of knocks out the Renate character, and that we see the camera's going down and it's going through the floor.
Through the floor.
Mm-hmm. And each pass, we're seeing kind of a reductive version of, you know, things that seem kind of normal at the top. And by the time we get to the bottom, it's this really abstracted, reductive thing. And, you know, as the visual effects, like, is it amazing visual effects? Like, No, like I don't. I would say it's not in a way, but it is.
It's functional to the story.
It's totally in perfect service of the story, and I think in that regard, it's true to the world, it's true to the story, and it's very much in keeping with, although I think it's better quality than the stuff that was done for the web series originally.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of like a leveling up of that technology, and of the thinking maybe behind it.
When Dr. Mary Klein first steps through the fake door, or the
wall, yeah.
Invisible door, the wall, yeah. There's a shot of her on the other side where they must have just had obviously a hole in the wall and they were filling it in with CG. And the keying on her in front of the wall for me was like a definite like, whoa, they didn't get time to finish that shot. it wasn't horrendous, but it was like not good. And you sort of had a nowhere else to look, right? Because there's a wall that's going from camera away from us, and it's just got this repeating pattern. So clearly all you're looking at in that frame is her standing there, and she's got hair that's a bit wispy at this stage. She's not all beaten up yet, but it was definitely like not the best key I've ever seen. I thought most of the Captain Monster guy was pretty good, but I thought some of the shots of the other reflected, poorly remembered characters looked like the makeup looked really obvious, or that they were inert kind of puppets. They just didn't have skin properties that lent themselves to being kind of technically believable for me.
They feel spongy.
Yeah. They just, and it, not in a way that I think could have been explicit. I don't imagine they were designed that way. They just felt proppy.
Yeah, I thought a lot of that stuff was probably practical too, right? I mean,
I would imagine.
I thought digital. So.
But yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, but
I can't remember what they call them in the lore. Like the they're not people, but they're called some kind of.
Yeah, I forget.
Like paper, something, or cutouts, or something. But yeah, I mean, again, though they're serviceable within the nature of that narrative. I mean, they fit a certain bill that when you first see the first guy with all the eyes, like the first glimpse of it is pretty eerie, but then the longer you look at it, you're like, oh,
that's, yeah,
like the guy with the lamp guy. That pulled the light on and off,
the little
he
guy,
just seemed he just seemed like Twin Peaks to me.
Yeah,
like if somebody told me that was a Twin Peaks inspired character, I'd have totally gone there.
I really like the environment when they go through like a hallway or something, and they're in that big kind of caverny space that's going down. Like that's obviously CG. In second, they're not building a 8-story set or whatever that was. I would imagine. I mean, maybe they built some of it, but that was like a nice break from the sort of single level, you know, fluorescent light kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Had some nice design to it.
What did we think about, is it Kat, or Bobby, you know, the store manager?
Yeah,
the two kids. I kind of felt unsatisfied with their demise. Like, they were like gone, and I felt sorry that we never got anything more from them. But I thought they were, the actors were performing well in the show. Like, I thought they contributed really well as.
Yeah, I felt like Bobby's demise was kind of more compelling in that, you know, he had gone down the chute, he was on the rope, and then he's being pulled back up, and then he's still tied around his waist, and it pulls him back down again. And then his, what was the name of his friend, the other woman?
Kat.
Kat. Yeah. And I think she's the young woman from that Apple TV show with what was it? Shrinking, I think, right?
Oh, I don't see it.
But, you know, I thought, you know, she was great. And the one thing I personally didn't feel like made sense was that in the scene at the table with Clark and the therapist, I can't remember her name, but
Mary,
when they're at the table and Clark opens the refrigerator and mm-hmm. her head is in the refrigerator, it's sort of like, how did that happen?
That's what I'm saying. It just didn't seem very fulfilling. I guess what I really like is when I feel like that the writers have really gone to town and thought through problems. Like someone was talking to me the other day about the film Bullet Train, you know, the one that... And it's an incredibly complicated plot, obviously absurd, but at least like somebody's kind of woven all of the stories through and done a really, really clever job of consequences and setting things up and like, yeah, it's insane and whatever, but nevertheless, like you feel like somebody got a whiteboard out and really bothered kind of, you know... Mm-hmm. ticking the boxes and then satisfyingly finishing things off. So things just didn't happen. In horror, generally, and in this film in particular, there's a couple of occasions where I was just like, well, that's not very satisfying. Like, what happened to her? Why?
I will agree that the plot is the weakest part. The script is the weakest part of this film, which is often the case for most films I don't care for. But I mean, I care for this film, but like when I have an issue in a film, it's usually the script, because to your exact point, it kind of isn't that hard to, and in 2026, to like really put your thinking cap on and tie everything together and decide maybe characters shouldn't say this, Christopher Nolan, or
what?
Maybe what? Characters should have less exposition or more or whatever. Anyway,
I'm sorry, The Odyssey is going to be the best film this year.
I can't wait to see the part where he says, like, he's my dad.
Well, hold on.
That'll be a good
hold
bit.
On. I'm gonna send you and we'll go through it when we do the show. But I'm gonna send you an Instagram reel that I saw by someone who actually very concretely and competently explains the modern language use in Nolan's Odyssey and which version of the Odyssey he adapted specifically. And
it
does make a lot of sense. I'm not sure I want him to do that, but it also does make sense. I'm going to say right now, it is my least anticipated film of the year for me.
Completely.
But of course I will see it.
It's the most anticipated film of the year.
I hope to be incredibly wrong and, you know, eat crow on the show.
I was going to say, though, about this film, I think, you know, the sort of character issues and plot holes, maybe notwithstanding, I think one of the things, it is the perfect example of, or a pretty well-executed example of the idea of the mystery box, right?
Yeah.
It is this endless puzzle. And like you said, I think, Jason, when you saw it with your son and some of his buddies, that the amount of conversation about, well, mm-hmm. what was this and what did that mean? And, oh, this was that. Like, I think that that's really compelling, that, you know, any movie that, you know, you leave the theater and you wind up talking about for a long time.
For sure.
For whatever reason. I mean, even if it was a terrible movie. Sometimes that's really fun, too. Like the social engagement that comes post mm-hmm. watching a film like that. So
I'm with you. There are films that I say I didn't like, but I actually found myself pondering them a lot. Mm-hmm. One of those films wasn't The Devil Wears Prada 2.
I think you meant to say Scott Pilgrim.
No. But the thing is, this film didn't do that for me either. Like, I didn't sort of think, well, now, how did the head get in the fridge? Or where was that guy at the beginning? Like, I was watching it and at some point I went, oh, we haven't got back to the beginning with the guys in the suits with the video gear and mm-hmm. the speakers and the stuff. That's still to come. Like, I'm waiting for it. There it is. Thank you. Like, it was, but
yeah,
I didn't like later go, oh, hang on. Now I think about it. Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, that's clever. Or like, that was just, wow, I didn't get that on the first viewing. I don't think I would get anything from this. If I watch this a second time, the only thing I'd get from it would be another really good nap, I think.
Oh, geez. Wow.
I just didn't realize that going in that the Clark character was such a terrible person. You start to get a glimpse of it when you see that he can't accept any responsibility for the demise of his marriage. But then the manifestation of that later is so interesting. I was going to say another great effects sequence that I think maybe was in that the same interview with the DP, but where they shot the area where there's the little houses that are sort of different colors that all look the same. And it kind of looks like an outdoor street, but it's a very indoor space. It actually is a real location that they shot outdoors and lit with a bunch of the, what do they call those? The big balloon.
Yeah. Big light. They flattened all the lighting.
Yeah. So it had,
so there's like no shadow really.
Which was so cool. And then extended the environment, right? So
yeah.
It looks like they're in that space. And I had no clue that that was not indoors when I saw it.
Yeah.
And they really pulled that shot off or that sequence off so well.
Good. Yeah. Because we so often go the other way, right? We say that exterior shot was obviously shot in a studio because the lighting didn't look right.
Yeah.
And here you've gone, that was an exterior, which they made the lighting poor, or not poor, but like inaccurate. Flat.
Yeah, because it has to look like an indoor.
So that, I know, I'll give it points for that. I absolutely. Look, you know, as I said, I think it's competent filmmaking, and I think that it's great that new directors get a break and do interesting things, and that people that are 17 have somewhere to go on dates and have fun and make a mess and throw popcorn at each other. I mean, that's all good, right? But for me, you guys making me see horror is, you know, I mean, yeah, no. And I know that you're going to make me do it again.
You make us see all those dumb Christopher Nolan movies.
That hack.
Literally some of the greatest cinema ever done. All right, guys, that's enough for this week. I think there's going to be another part in this. We might do The Burrows, which is a interesting sci-fi TV show, but also we've got Disclosure Day coming up, hopefully. So we've got a bunch of things coming, as well as The Great Odyssey, which is just around the corner. But until then, I'll say thanks to the panel for being here. Jason, again, following what you're doing.
I'm in the back rooms.
What's up with your?
I'm in the back rooms. There's a big monster that looks like me named Josh. you can find them in there if you want. Anywhere you want to type in the Diamond Bros or my name into the internet, you'll find me.
Professor Matt?
I'm on Letterboxd. That's the best place to find me for reaching out and we can talk movies. And then just if, I don't know if we have any listeners in Sweden or Denmark, but I'm going to be in Sweden and Denmark for 3 weeks starting a week on next Monday. Yeah, this is coming Monday.
Around the time this 14th? Comes out. Just after this comes out.
Yeah. So if that's true, if anybody out there wants to meet up, it'd be fun to meet some crazy Nordic.
How would they connect with you?
They could reach out through my website, mattwallen.com.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, I'm sure there are horror devotees who now have a voodoo doll of Mike Seymour that they're keen to stick their pins into and get their clowns to come out with their creepy balloons and
chainsaws,
of course, chainsaws, hockey masks, and massively head wound Harry type burn scenarios. But until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.